is that your eigenvalue? Is it? Still does. Well, then you can just you can check analytically if what you're doing is right. Okay, so while everybody else are getting their coffee, I'll read you this little story. So we remember that we talked about inverting a matrix. Calculating the inverse of A, right? Now, if I have a matrix that's orthogonal, then I know that the inverse of an orthogonal matrix is just its transpose, right? Okay? So now the story. It was 1949, so I guess that's 61 years ago, in Southern California. Our computer was a very new CPC, Model 1, number 1. A 1 second per arithmetic operation clunker, and we talked about the fact that what you're sitting in front of is probably doing a few billion operations per second. That was holding the computational fort while an early electronic monster was being coaxed into life in an adjacent room. From a nearby aircraft company arrived one day a 16 by 16 matrix, and I believe that was probably a huge aircraft company. So they got this 16 by 16 matrix of 10-digit numbers whose inverse was desired. We really had asked for it. Our matrix inversion routine was new and barely tested, and the CPC represented a tremendous, if as yet untested or unrealized, increase in computing capacity over a room full of girls with desk calculators. We had offered to demonstrate our prowess and in walked this matrix. Okay, 16 by 16 matrix. Okay. We labored for 2 days, and after the usual number of glitches that accompany any strange procedure involving repeated handling of intermediate decks of data cards, we were in possession of an inverse matrix. During the checking of operations, which involved the multiplication of the inverse by the original, it was noted that to 8 significant figures, the inverse was the transpose of the original matrix. A hurried visit to the aircraft company to explore the source of the matrix revealed that each element had been laboriously hand-computed from some rather simple combinations of sines and cosines of a common angle. It took about 10 minutes to prove that the matrix was indeed orthogonal. We were less than overjoyed, although philosophically speaking, it was a good test of the inversion routine. A 16 by 16 matrix, that was about state of the art in those days. That was about 2 days of hard work shuffling data cards. So the first electronic computers, instead of on a large scale commercial basis, was from the early 60s. And if I remember my computer history correctly, one of the first ones that was marketed was by the CDC, the Control Data Corporation. Their chief engineer at the time was Seymour Cray. They had so little money, and the transistors that were used to build these computers were so expensive that the the only way they built the first prototype was that they invited the representatives over from the semiconductor companies and offered them lunch, and then the representatives would always give them free samples. And after enough lunches, they managed to build the first transistor-based computer. But and then Seymour Cray, of course, went on to built many other high-performance computers. So we talked about this little Jacobi routine, and I hope you had a bit of fun with it yesterday. I think I'm gonna probably spend the entire lecture today telling you about what you'll be doing for the tutorial today. So the problem is what to do if the size of this matrix is large. So I showed you one really large matrix that was defined by Google, and clearly we could, well, maybe you're going to tell me that the internet is useless, but at least somebody made money of solving on solving this problem. And if you look at quantum mechanical models, and I'll show you one explicitly that you'll be using for the tutorial, you'll see that the size of the Hilbert space, if I define it on a lattice, it grows exponentially. So it's very, very easy to write down a matrix and at least formally define it, and you can't really treat it. For this purpose, we would use what are sometimes called sparse matrix techniques. The idea is, there are several of these techniques, and the idea is quite similar between most of them. So the one that I'll try to outline today is called the Lanczos technique. So I'll try to explain to you how this works. So when we say that the matrix here is sparse, then what we mean by this is that most of the entries in the matrix is zero. You can define a measure of the sparseness and so forth. But for practical purposes, really what we're interested in, if I define my matrix and I call it H here, because in the end we're actually going to calculate it explicitly as a Hamiltonian. So when we say that something here is sparse, then for practical purposes, we mean that we have figured out a way to calculate the matrix applied to a vector, right? So before I wrote AX here, I'm going to switch the notation slightly, so I use bra and ket, but it all doesn't matter. What I mean by this is that I can actually take the matrix here and then apply it to a vector. Okay, and so I'm going to assume that the matrix is very big, and I can still perform this operation. And if you look at your matrix and you see that almost anything in the matrix is zero, then you can think of ways of performing this calculation in a simple manner that would be a lot less costly than filling up an n by n array and then multiplying everything together as we would do. So a standard, if you don't think about it, if I look at this operation here and the matrix is n by n, then unless you're using clever technique, then the number of operations would be n cubed. You can actually do a little bit better than that, but we're not going to go into details about that. So if this here is n cubed, then and the matrix is of a size of a billion or so, then we can't do that. So we have to be a little bit more clever in doing this, and I'll show you an example of how this can be done. But what is now the idea? And so this story, I want to start a little bit back and tell you about the simplest thing that we can do. So the Lanczos technique, one way of looking at it is that it, if you like, the roots is in what's called the power method here. And so what's the power method? Well, that's very simple here. If I look at H here, well, so let's assume that A here, it has eigenvalues which I have an extremal one which is bigger than the next one, and then the remaining ones can be positioned as you please. Right, so I have something like this, and note that this here is a Schwab inequality, so I'm going to be assumed. Yes?
Why is it the number of operations of order n cubed? Because we just n squared multiplied by h squared.
No. Did I say that incorrectly? Yeah, no, you're right. It's it's n squared. It's the matrix multiplication, that's n cubed, yeah. Yeah, sorry, I said that incorrectly. It's n squared, but that doesn't, it's still too much. So we look at this, and then the simplest thing that we can do here, if I look at my matrix A here, is I can apply, so if I know these eigenvalues, then I assume here that there exists eigenvectors, and the eigenvectors, I'm going to call them x1 here and then up to xn. Okay, of course, A here on xi, it's equal to lambda xi. And if I now do this, then I can write a general vector here, I as y here, which is just b1 x1 plus b2 x2 plus b3 x3 and then up to bn xn. So if I do this, then obviously if I take the matrix and apply it to y here, then I'll just get lambda 1 b1 x1 plus lambda 2 b2 x2 and so forth. And the last one here will just be lambda 1 bn xn. So if I do this, and I then pull out the lambda 1 here, then you can see that I get lambda 1 b1 x1, and then lambda 2 over lambda 1, and lambda n over lambda 1. And then you can probably guess what we're going to be doing, because if I then do this n times, then I can just pull out a, so I get a lambda 1 to the power n, and then b1 x1 here, and then plus some lambda 2 over lambda 1 here to the power n, and then b2 x2, and so forth, and this will be lambda n over lambda 1 to the power n, bn xn here. Okay, so if this here is true, that I have an eigenvalue which is dominant, then we would assume that these should go to zero. And actually, if I just think about it, and I can decompose my vector here on the basis of the eigenvectors, and I keep applying this matrix, then I'll go more and more in the direction of the dominant eigenvector. So I can exploit this here to very simply write a little routine that will just give me give me the dominant eigenvalue and eigenvector. I can do something like the following here. I take y here, which is just a times x, and then I say that lambda here, well, it should be the length of y divided by the length of x here, and then I say that x is equal to y divided by the length of y, and then I do end do, right? So I keep rescaling back, and if this here holds true, that I have a dominant eigenvector or eigenvalue, then in fact this here will converge, and then at the end I can just can have a little print statement here, and I can just print out x, well, lambda and x. And that should be the extremal eigenvalue, and it should be the corresponding eigenvector.
What about the sign of lambda?
It doesn't matter. In this setting here, it you're going to pick out the, in absolute value, the most, the biggest one. That will mean that you may have to shift up and down your matrix by a constant, that's, of course, what people do. So if you, once you get going with this, yes. Yes, yes, yes. So anything I'll be talking about, you can imagine that A here, it came out of a matrix that basically defined as a Hamiltonian, so it's a Hermitian. Although these techniques can be generalized, but yes.
The original y vector.
That's a very, very good point. We need to make sure here that the first x here has an overlap with x1. Do you know how one might do that? It's a very stupid trick. Yeah. Well, we don't know, but what you do is something very simple. You fill it with random numbers. Right? In other words, I try to take a vector from the Hilbert space as random as possible. And then, well, you would really, really have to be unlucky that it was orthogonal to the ground state eigenvector. And that actually, in practice, always works. If you go in and initialize it and set it to something for you that looks simple, then, in fact, you would likely to, or it's possible to do this, so it would be orthogonal to the desired eigenvector. And actually, when you do this afternoon, you're going to be doing precisely that. It's going to take an eigenvector and fill it up with random numbers and then normalize it. Yes? Well, here, at this point, I'm just focusing on the extremal one. You're way ahead of me. yes. There's a problem here if lambda 1 is just very close to lambda 2, then we have a problem. And the other problem that you're bringing up is that there's going to be something about the degeneracies. And if we look at the degeneracies, these techniques will not be able to capture the degeneracies. That's the end result, that you're going to have to pay a price, and that will be that you can't really reliably figure out how degenerate the eigenvalue is. If you know something about it, then you can probably poke around for a special case, but for a general matrix and so forth, then it's not going to be possible. But let me get back. Yeah, what were you? This one?
Yes.
Thanks. But let me get back to the point that you were saying. Once we look at this, then we could say, well, why not be a little bit clever and then modify what we do here and then do, then let's look at a case where we... let's call this case 2 here. Suppose that lambda n here is bigger than 0, and it's bigger than lambda n minus 1. And then we, it's smaller than lambda n minus 1, and this is bigger than a less than l minus n minus 2, and then we go up to lambda 1. And what you're interested in is not the biggest one, lambda 1 here, but you're interested in the smallest one, right? So if we look at this, then we say here that if we look at the inverse of A, okay, it will have eigenvalues that are 1 over lambda n here. And this, I can now say, is bigger than 1 over lambda n minus 1, and this would be bigger than 1 over lambda 1. So if I'm interested in this one, which would be the smallest one, then I could say, well, I could just repeat this trick here, and then instead of doing what I'm doing here, then I could do what's called an inverse power method. And you can see that in order to modify the whatever I have here, all I would have to do is I would have to calculate y, which would be equal to a minus 1 on x. And then you say to yourself, well, this sounds not very promising, because I would actually have to calculate the inverse of this matrix, and if it's not orthogonal, I wouldn't know how to do this. But you then just move a over on the other side here, and then you say to yourself, well, suppose I was lucky enough that I could do what we talked about yesterday, LU decomposition, then I could actually solve this set of linear equations for y here. So I can play these games, and of course I can then get clever here and go in and maybe let's have one that over here. I can look at this, and then I can say, well, so let's look here in case 3 here. Suppose I want eigenvalues close to a constant mu, right? So I know that, for instance, my Fermi energy for some model is sitting at mu, and I have a big matrix or something like this, and I want to look at the eigenvalues that are close to this number. And then I look at Ax here, which I assume has some eigenvalues. Once I do this, I can look at A minus mu here times I, x here, and that would, of course, have eigenvalues lambda minus mu times x. And then I go over here and say, well, in this case, I now want to look at eigenvalues that are very close to zero. So I can run this inverse power method here, and I can run it on the inverse of the matrix minus mu times the eigenvalue. So that would have eigenvalues. So if I multiply this on some x here, it would have eigenvalues which are lambda 1 over lambda minus mu, and then apply to x. And this number would, of course, be big once lambda is close to mu. And then I can play the game. So these techniques are actually used extensively for the Langstroth technique. You can see whether you want the smallest one, the largest one, or if you want to shift them, and they do precisely what we do here. But we can also get clever. Because let's look here at case 4.
Suppose I had found the extremal lambda 1 and then the associated x1 here, then can I get lambda 2? And that's not so hard either, even though in praxis it may require a bit more work here. So I can do this by defining A prime here, which is just the original matrix, but then I just subtract off lambda 1 here, and times the projector along x1. Right? So if I do this, you can see that A prime here on x1, that's simply going to be AX1 and then minus lambda 1 X1, and that's 0. And then for all other eigenvectors, then if I look at A prime applied to X2, for instance, then it'll just be AX2. So the idea here is very simple. I subtract off the projection on the space that's coming from X1. Whether you can make that numerically stable is a bit of a question, but so you can work this quite a bit and actually get set it up so that you don't necessarily need to work with just the extremal eigenvalue. But of course what you do in the end is that you just reformulate the problem so that what you what you're calculating is the extremal eigenvalue of another problem. So if we look at this basic power method here, you can see that once I apply the matrix many times, the idea is that the resulting vector will have a larger and larger overlap with the extremal eigenvector. And so let's look at the Langsas technique and see what it does. And so, and I'm going to switch to using a notation like this one. So the idea is that we look at a subspace, and if you go over to the applied math department, they'll call this a Krylov subspace. The subspace is very simple here. It's our initial vector, which again we're actually going to choose as a random starting vector here, and then it's simply just the sequence that we talked about before. So I look at the vector and then the matrix applied to the vector, and then h squared on that, and then maybe down to h m on that.
So maybe this won't be a huge illustration, but let's assume that this here is the entire Hilbert space in some abstract manner, and then I have my little Krylov subspace. So let's call this K. So this is the entire Hilbert space, and this here is K or kappa. I claim from what I told you about the power method that the extremal eigenvalues for the, or the extremal eigenvector should be, it should have a huge overlap with this subspace. So it should be in that subspace somehow. Right, so we say that the extremal x1 here is in here. Although precisely what I mean here by in here, what I mean by this is that if I continue this process to a high enough m, then the overlap will with the extremal or the eigenvector is going to be approaching 1 here. So what we're going to do now is very simple. We will define an orthonormal basis for kappa and project H onto the subspace. Right? So I'm gonna look at the action of the Hamiltonian in this restricted subspace. If the original Hilbert space here is some some exponentially large Hilbert space, then the reduced Hilbert space here for the Krylov subspace will be much smaller here. So let's say the dimension here is maybe some enormous number n, and the dimension here of kappa, it's just m. And in order for this to be of any practical use, then we of course want m here to be much, much bigger than, or much, much less than n, right? So think about starting with an exponentially large Hilbert space, an n here which is very, very big, and then I form this little subspace here, and I have an m here which is maybe, for practical purposes, of order 100, 300 or so. That means that when I project the Hamiltonian on there, initially it might be some n by n matrix, enormous, but in the subspace it'll just be a small m by m matrix, and that I can handle, right? So the in spirit, it's very much like the power method, except for in a subtle way, I take into account the knowledge of all the other vectors in the subspace, and I'm, if you like, when I then diagonalize the projected Hamiltonian here, I'm explicitly removing all the other components that we were just, with the power method, hoping that they would be small enough to ignore, right? So that's the idea. So we need to do this, and then I need to write the Hamiltonian then in that subspace, and then we want to diagonalize that Hamiltonian. We want to diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the subspace. Are you with me with the idea of doing this? Right? So I instead of taking the full basis, I just take a small subspace and write the Hamiltonian in that subspace. And, but it's not any subspace. It's a cleverly chosen subspace that I chose in this way. So maybe let's start over here. And there is an added wrinkle to why this becomes interesting, and I'll try to tell you about that. So again, here we so let's try to get the orthogonal bases. And well, I start here with a random, let's call it U1 here. So I just fill a vector with random numbers, and then I define a normalized vector, which I call V1, and I'm just going to write this as U1, and then divide it with some measure of the length of that vector. Okay, so unnormalized vector and normalized vector. Do you remember how you construct an orthogonal basis? Yes, yes. So Gramm was actually Jørgen Gramm, mathematician from Copenhagen, and he worked in the insurance industry. Thought maybe you'd like to know that, but okay. The so we do this, and what do we do next after that? Well, I of course look at U2 here, and the way I get to U2 is I apply the Hamiltonian to V1 here, and then I subtract off the projection along V1 here. But that would just be V1, HV1, right? Okay, this number here I'm going to call alpha 1. And this equation here, I'm going to call that one for equation 1. And then, of course, over here, I'm going to do V2 here, and I'm going to say that that is U2, and then divide it with the length U2. So far, so good. And then, of course, once we've done this, we immediately see that V1 here on V2, per definition or by construction, those two vectors are going to be orthogonal, right? When I subtract off this part. That's the whole idea of the Gram-Schmidt, right? So once I'm done with this, I continue and I define U3 now. And that's H on V2. And then I subtract off the projection along V1 here, so that would be V1 here, and then HV2. And then I also now have to subtract off the projection along V2 here, so that would be V2, HV2, and then in the direction V2. Okay, so once I'm done with that, then I say that V3 here, it's U3, and then divided by its norm. So, and of course here by construction, then V1 here, V3 is equal to V2, V3, and that's equal to 0. So this is just standard Gram-Schmidt, and we haven't been We're just working our way through the first year vector calculus textbook. So now we come to the point where things get a little bit more murky, because I'm now going to do U4 here. And as you can guess, I apply the matrix to V3 that I just defined here. And by the way, let me point out that this one here, if I call this one alpha 1, then this here I'm going to call alpha 2. But then the one I defined here, I'm going to call that beta 2. Okay, alpha 1, alpha 2, and beta 2. Now I look at this one, and I continue what I was doing. So I'm going to subtract off the projection along V3 first now. So that would be V3, HV3. And then I'm going to subtract off the projection along V2. So this is V2, HV3, and then along V2. And this here, in analogy with what I've been doing, I'm going to call this alpha 3. And this here, beta 3. But now I'm going to stop. And you could say, well, how come? Because if you remember Graham Smith, then you would say that I should actually subtract off also the projection along V1. But what I'll try to convince you, and of course here we're gonna define V4 here as U4 and then divide it by U4. So as before, by construction here, if I look at my V4 and then the dot product with V3, it's equal to V4 and then the dot product with V2, and they're equal to 0 because I subtracted out these two projections. So what we need to worry about is the last one. And so I need to look at V1 and then the scale up or inner product with V4. V4 here, I'm going to forget about the normalization. So I'm just going to look at V1 and then the dot product with U4. Okay, so I go up and look at what's written here. So it's going to be basically V1 and then HV3, right? And V1 is by construction orthogonal to V3 and to V2, so I get a minus 0 and a minus 0. Okay? So in other words, if I want to convince you that V1 is orthogonal to U4, I just have to convince you that this here is 0, right? So then I have to look at HV3 here, and then I go over and let's call this equation here, let's call this one 2 here. So from 2 here, what do I get here? Well, I would say that I'm just going to replace V3 here by 1 over the norm of U3, and then I'm going to look at the scalar product with V1 H U3. So I can go over and read off what it should be there by just applying a V1H to this whole thing, right? So what am I going to get there? I'm going to get a V1 and then an H squared V2. And then I'm going to get a minus, well, let's write it beta 2, and then V1 H V1, and then minus alpha 2, and then V1 H V2, right? And this here we called that one alpha 1, and this here we called beta 2. So I basically have alpha 1 beta 2 and then alpha 2 beta 2. Okay, so then I just need to play with this one and see what comes out of that one. So I need to from 1 here, I can just go over here and look, and so I claim that I claim here that H V1 here, by just moving around, it's some U2, the norm of U2 here, and then V2, and then plus actually something that's alpha 1 V1. Right, and this I'm gonna stick in here. So when I look at V1 here, H squared V2, then I'm gonna write this as V1 here, H, and then H V2, and then I'm gonna stick in a sum here. But this here, I just need to put in the sum over these two vectors here. So I claim that I can write this as a sum here over alpha equal to 1 and 2, and then V1 H, and then, well, let's call it I here, then VI, and then VI here, H V2. And then when you write out what these are according to the definitions I have over here, then I get alpha 1 beta 2 and then plus alpha 2 beta 2. And that's precisely what I have here. So this is 0. So something magical now happens because I only need to orthonormalize, or well, let's look at it, the subtract off projections on 2 preceding vectors. And well, you can elaborate on this, but the argument that I presented here, it continues to hold. So when you look at when we go and do the next one here, which is U5, then I look at HV4 here, and then I subtract off the projection along V4 and then along V3. And by construction here, this is now orthogonal to, of course, V4 and V3, but
also to V2 and V1, even though we didn't subtract them off explicitly. Right? So this here would be alpha 4 here, and then beta 4. So I have my basis, and I claim that I can get it rather efficiently. So now we need to do the next step in what we talked about. And so we have the basis, right? So now to the next step, I want to write H in the subspace Kaba here. So I take my Hamiltonian now, and then I list my vectors here, so V1 up to Vm here, and then I take the V1s here up to Vm. And then we look at the result here, and this will be, well, V1, H V1. And then the next one here will be V1, H V2. And then the next one will be V1, H V3. And below this one, of course, we're going to have V2, H, V1. And then V2, H, V2, and so forth. Now, if you have followed what we've done here, you can see that the matrix elements that go in here are just the alphas and betas that we have defined. The first one would be alpha 1. So that's this one. And that's what we call beta 2. And then you can see here that I just, what did we just do this? If I look here at V1 HV3, I just showed you that that was 0. So actually, the matrix that we get is tridiagonal. So I claim here that what I write here, V up to Vm here, and then H, and then V1 up to Vm here, that is actually just alpha 1, beta 2, and then zeros, beta 2, alpha 2, beta 3, zeros, and then a zero here, beta 3, alpha 3, beta 4. And so forth. So this thing here is tridiagonal. And actually, when Lanczos proposed this in the late 1950s, it was proposed as a method for tridiagonalizing a matrix. Right? Yes?
That was 0. You just put in the sum of those two vectors.
Yeah.
Why can you do that?
Because that was the equation 1 over there. And what's a little bit more tricky to see that this works recursively. When I go to the next step, it also plays out. So the magic of it is that you end up with this tridiagonal matrix, and that should be an M by M matrix, and that should be a fairly small, and of course, so
when you're you don't really need to construct the basics or the well, you're going to be generating the orthogonal basis explicitly, but you only need to keep the two previous basis vectors in order to generate the alphas and betas that you need to build up this M by M matrix. So in total, when you run this algorithm, you just need three vectors. So I only need to store, well, and actually you only need to store two, but well, I don't need, only need to, let's write it like this, to store no more than three vectors. I don't need to write out the big matrix. I only need to know how I apply it to a vector. And in order to calculate these alphas that would define my tridiagonal matrix, I actually only need to have three vectors in memory. And that was then realized later on that this was actually very useful, because in Lanczos' initial idea, you would be working all the way up so that M would be equal to N here, and I would have really tridiagonalized the matrix. But then it was realized, well, if I just stop with some M that's very much smaller than the initial size of the matrix, I can get these extremal eigenvalues easily. And that's it, right? So in order to write a program, and you'll be using one this afternoon, what we're going to do here is we're just generating the alphas and betas, and then we built a tridiagonal matrix. And there are very efficient ways of finding the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of a tridiagonal matrix, but you have one that'll do it anyway, and that was the Jacobi method you used from yesterday's tutorial. And it's no sweat for your Jacobi routine just to find the eigenvalues of this one. So when you run it for the tutorial, maybe you want to take M here up to 50. Maybe if you're ambitious, you can take it up to 100. You don't need much more than that to actually calculate the extremal eigenvalues to sufficient precision. And so let me just show you. Another little added wrinkle here, and so I'm going to call this matrix here for L, or maybe we could, yeah, because it's the Lanczos matrix, right? Suppose I find all the eigenvectors of L here, right? And can I then use that to find the eigenvectors of the initial Hamiltonian? And that turns out to be not too hard. So if I have x1 here and then down to xn in some matrix, and then I have my tridiagonal matrix L here, and then over on the other side I've arranged them in okay, this is M here, I've arranged them so they're columns here, then per definition, this is going to give me lambda 1 and then to up to lambda m here, okay?
But then, and these would be M by M matrices. And this here would also be an M by M matrix. But then I'm just going to go in and say, well, L here, I actually got it by the operation that I just removed here. So I would claim that what I've written here is actually x1 and then up to xm. And then I have another matrix here, which is now very much longer than its high, and that would have v1 here, and then up to vm here, and that would be a matrix which would be, so this here is m by m, and this here is m by n, and then I have h here. And H, I then apply a matrix which is very much higher than its, so this would be an N by M matrix here, than its wide. So it, this goes up to Vm. And then I need my last one here, which is the x1 here up to xm. And this here is an m by m matrix, right? H here is, of course, n by n. And this is going to give me the eigenvalues here, lambda 1 up to lambda n. So from looking at this one, you can see that I can get that the expression that I have here that actually gives me the eigenvectors of the original Hamiltonian. So the eigenvectors of H here, what I need to do here is I need to take my basis vectors for the Krylov subspace that I generated, which would be very big, right? So they would look something like V1 here, and then V2, and then up to how many we generated, and Vm. And then I need to form linear combinations of them by applying the X1 to Xm here. So I look at the X1 here, X2 up to Xm. And that will give me a sequence of vectors here of, so that would give me M vectors of length N, right? So this here gives me the eigenvectors of H. So what I'm trying to write here is all you need to know is the eigenvalues or the eigenvectors of the Lanczos matrix, and use that to form linear combinations of the basis vectors of the Krylov subspace, and that can easily be done. Of course, again, you should remember that the idea of projecting it onto the subspace is that you're hoping for getting the extremal eigenvalues to a fairly good precision. So you can only hope that maybe this will give you the first one or two eigenvectors and the first one or two eigenvalues, maybe not all of them. Yes?
What was the operation on that set of plots? You have...
It's the product of two matrices.
Is that... Is that part of...
Yeah. This matrix here, it has n rows and m columns. And over here, I have m columns and m rows.
Well, it's exactly what's on this side.
Yes, I just took this one. You can, of course, write this out with some mathematical indices.
But I find that more obscure.
But the upshot of it is that from the knowledge of X1 to XM, I can use that to form linear combinations of the V1s to VM, and those should be the eigenvectors. And that's the mathematical operations that you would have to do. For the tutorial this afternoon, you don't need to get the eigenvectors. All you sort of need to know here is that it can be fairly easily done. With a little caveat that I'm actually going to have to access all these V1 and V2s again here. And maybe you didn't keep those around. Okay, so there are some problems here that I want to point to. And the first one here is, of course, that you only get a few eigenvectors or eigenvalues. The other thing is that, as one of you pointed out, if I look at the degeneracy, then probably from symmetries of the underlying problem, then I know that the eigenvalues are going to come in some degeneracies here. Once I project onto this Krylov subspace, then that information, for practical purposes, is lost, right? What you're actually doing is that you're taking your exponentially large matrix, and then you're concocting a little, maybe 50 by 50, 100 by 100 matrix, and you're claiming that the information you have in that little matrix will give you the eigenvalues of the big matrix, and something will be lost in that process. And so sometimes it's possible to say something about the degeneracies, but on general grounds, they're going to be lost. We're going to be looking at a model defined for a spin chain, and if you know how angular momentum combines, then you can predict the degeneracies for some of the eigenvalues, and you could be looking for doublets, triplets, singlets in the spectrum, but there's not much point in looking to identify that in the little triangular matrix or tridiagonal matrix that we have here, because that will be lost. Then the other thing that you might encounter is that you somehow or sometimes get what are called spurious eigenvalues. And those are eigenvalues that you really shouldn't be finding, and in the sense that they will occur in the tridiagonal matrix that you have calculated, but they're actually not true eigenvalues of H here. And one can show that then that these spurious eigenvalues, they occur because we have a loss of orthogonality. So I'm generating this sequence of V1 through Vm, and I'm claiming magically that the Gram-Schmidt, I only have to make it explicitly orthogonal to the two previous ones. But if I run this out to hundreds of eigenvectors, then you could be a little bit worried that the last one you're generating is actually, to within numerical precision, orthogonal to the first one. And in some cases, it happens that you have a numerical loss of orthogonality. So the sequence of eigenvectors, or the sequence of basis vectors for the Krylov subspace, it actually is not as orthogonal as you would like. And that is reflected in the fact that you will get eigenvalues that are what's called spurious. Usually, this is a very benign problem, and in most cases, it doesn't occur for the extremal eigenvalues.
But it's possible that if you monitor this very closely, you can see that one of the eigenvalues for the tridiagonal matrix, if I plot it as a function of the size of the tridiagonal matrix, then it looks well-defined, and then at some point it splits into two. So I get two eigenvalues that are within 10 to the minus 6 or 10 to the minus 7 of each other. And if with a little bit of, so there are techniques of eliminating these spurious eigenvalues. And in most cases, you can actually see that this could not be an eigenvalue of the actual Hamiltonian. So there are ways of dealing with this. For the tutorial that you'll be doing this afternoon, I don't think we will see any of these spurious eigenvalues. But if you ever actually happen to use this for a real-life problem, then you may end up observing one of these. And there are techniques for dealing with them, right? So it's possible to eliminate them. Do you see the general idea of what's going on? Take your big initial matrix, project it onto a smaller subspace. In doing that, you construct a tridiagonal matrix, which is fairly small, and you just run Jacobian that, and you've solved the problem. Cute, right? Yes?
Not really sure the size of our subsystem. Not really sure the size of our subsystem.
Yeah, so the... what you would be doing, and I believe that we're going to do this for the tutorial, I look at the eigenvalues of L here, and of course you're interested in either the biggest one or the smallest one, and you can plot this as the size of the tridiagonal matrix. And what you'll see is that it'll very quickly converge and attain a very stable value. You're actually going to look at that for the tutorial. In praxis, you can, well, you can't run this up to enormous sizes. So you're usually, if this Lanczos method works, then you would only need to do a few hundred iterations. So the size of the Krylov subspace would be typically 300 to 500, something like this. If you have to go beyond that, then you have problems, and so usually that's not done. Does that answer your question? But you would monitor, and that's how it's done. You just monitor, because this matrix here is so small that as you're building it up, there's almost no cost in just diagonalizing it as you go along, and so you just do that, and then you look at when do the extreme eigenvalues look like they have converged. Then you can just see more and more digits occurring. So I should tell you about the problem that we're going to look at. So the problem here is the spin 1/2 spin chain. And famously, this was solved by Bethe in, I think, 1931. Maybe it was 27. And if you look at the original paper, which is in German, his affiliation is just Hans Bethe in Rome. And I think, according to the anecdote, he was just there on vacation and over coffee, and he just wrote down the solution to this problem, which is a famous solution that has generated a whole industry of solving models exactly based on what's called the Bethe ansatz. We're not going to talk about that. And actually, the program that you'll be using is quite general, and in 2 minutes you can modify it so you can study any quantum spin model that would be impossible to solve with these techniques. But we want to work with a problem where I can cross-check with the analytical solution. So we're just going to look here at some quantum spins, and let's just assume that they're sitting here on a number of discrete sites here. So call this one the first one L1 and the last one L here. And then the next thing you need to know is that we're actually going to impose periodic boundary conditions. So if we had time to discuss magnetism, I could tell you a lot about how you build these models, but for our purposes, then the quantum spins here, they interact with what's called the Heisenberg interaction, or Heisenberg model here. So when I write down the Hamiltonian for this set of spins here, then it's a simple sum over the dot product here between the spin at position I and then I plus 1, and then the spin at position L plus 1, I define it or identify it with the first spin. So that's my periodic boundary conditions. Now, this here is a spin model. So when I write something like this, it's actually defined in terms of the Pauli matrices. So this here is a vector of these spin one-half matrices. For what we'll be talking about, we're not going to put in explicit values of H bar, so I'll just assume that the prefactor is one-half. Okay, so I now need to look at the Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space here, that's a product space. So if I look at one spin here, then I'm sure you're familiar with that I can write the action of the spin here in terms of the Pauli matrices, and by some convention, usually it's done in the S set basis, and that's reflected in the fact that the Pauli matrix here for sigma set is just a diagonal matrix. So sigma set here, it turns out to be just 1 and then minus 1. And then if we quantize along that direction, then the two other Pauli matrices are, of course, not diagonal. So when I say here the S set basis, then actually what I mean by this here is spin up here, sigma set, spin up, and then spin up, sigma set, spin down, sigma set, spin up, and then the last element here is spin down, sigma set, spin down, okay? So when we write these Pauli matrices, we're explicitly referring to some basis, and that basis is in the set direction, so that these are actually the eigenvalues of the operator S set. So I'm gonna for the single spin, I assume that my basis here is just either up or down. Okay. So then I do two spins here. And then you can see that I now need to use some kind of product notation. And
So I can assume the first one is pointing up, and then the second one is also pointing up, and then, well, the first one pointing up, and then the second one pointing down, and then first one pointing down, the second one pointing up, and then the first one pointing down, the second one pointing down. Okay. As a shorthand for this, often we would just write up here, and then up down, and then down up here, and down, right? And likely you may have seen this many times before, but I'm going to now number these states, right? So I'm going to say that in my mind, instead of doing up here, I'm going to write this as a 0, 0. And this here, I'm going to write this as 0, 1. And that one as a 1, 0. And this one as a 1, 1. Right? Instead of just doing up arrows and down arrows, I'm going to be using 0 and 1s. Okay? This here is a binary code for an integer, and we talked about how integers are represented. So you can see that this here is the integer number 0. This is the integer number 1. This is the integer number 2, and this here is the integer number 3. Right? So when we look at this, there is a one-to-one correspondence between this integer, for instance, the number 2 in binary, and the corresponding basis state, right? And the basis state in this case would be down up. Get it, right? So when I talk about basis state number 3, I know the binary code, it corresponds to down down. Okay? And this naturally generalizes if I did not have 2 spins, but if I had n spins, then I would need n bits in my integer, and I just need to look at the binary code and then interpret the zeros as spin up and the ones as spin down. So now we need to act with the Hamiltonian on one of these states. And so it can be shown here, and you can work out the algebra, that if I just focus on SI plus 1, then I get a quarter from the half in the Pauli matrices, and then actually now a 4 by 4 matrix that would be acting in this space here. And that 4 by 4 matrix is 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1, 2, and 2. Okay, so if I look at that, then I look at 4 SI plus 1 here. And then I add the identity matrix to it, and then I divide it by 2. And then I get a matrix which is 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1. And that, we of course remember that this here is a permutation matrix.
right? So now I want to figure out how the Hamiltonian, it actually acts on a state here. So I look at, so let's look at the Hamiltonian applied to a vector here, A0, A1, A2, A3. But you can see that actually I can write this here by looking at, so I can write here that H here, let's call this matrix here, let's call that equal to P here. So if I look at 2P here, and then minus I, and then divided by 4, then that's equal to the Hamiltonian. But you can see if I, taking into account an identity matrix for the diagonalization, that's totally trivial. So in order to figure out how this here acts on a given state, I just need to figure out how this permutation matrix it will act. So remember what I just told you here about the binary representation of this up and down spin here. So immediately when I now look at P applied to that vector here, A1, A2, A3 here, all it's actually going to do is that it's going to give me back A0, but then it'll permute A2 and A1. So I get something like this. That's all that happens. Right? So when you want to figure out now a problem which has a larger Hilbert space, it has more spins here, then each of these terms here, Si, Si plus 1, all they'll just do here is that they'll interchange these two bits. And for your purposes, it means that your incoming vector, I'm going to have to take an entry here and then add it to the entry in the outgoing vector where I have just interchanged two bits in the index that was here. Are you all confused now? Don't worry about it, because for the tutorial, we going to give you the matrix that does this. So it's just for the purpose of explaining how the matrix actually does the matrix vector multiplication. Yes?
At all, because of the recipe that doesn't change them.
Say that again. The A zeros here.
Yeah, and day three. So they remain there. So we don't have to care about them.
Well, all you need to do is you need to copy them into the. So what you do here is that you look at A zero. And you see, where should I stick that in the outgoing vector? Well, I just commute 0 on 0 here, and I get 0 again. So it should go in to here, the outgoing vector. So the list here of the indices of the outgoing vector, I have bits I and I plus 1 interchange. That's all that happens. And by analogy, if I'm now looking at the interaction between k and k plus 1, when I want to look at how that acts on the incoming vector, I'm just interchanging bit k and k plus 1.
function.
And
what if you set OCP 1 up to be a higher CP?
Well, then you can, of course, still do this. This little trick here of rewriting it as a permutation matrix, it's going to be more complicated. And you would have to choose a better way of labeling the states than I did here. But it's possible things just become more cumbersome. For the spin 1/2 models, it's very efficient. I'm just doing a mapping between an integer and the spin configuration, and I can figure out the action of the Hamiltonian here very easily. And so all I'm just doing is permutations. And magically, this works for any Hamiltonian that you would like to write down in these terms. I don't have to specify it so it's on a linear chain. I can do it for an n-dimensional system, stick in all kinds of strange interactions, and look for spin liquid states and so forth. So the routine that you'll be looking or using this afternoon, it's called HVF90, and it's only, I think, 15 lines. And if you read it, then this is what it's doing. It's just taking the whatever component was in the incoming vector and then sticking it somewhere else in the outgoing vector. And where it sticks it in the outgoing vector, all it did was that it just permuted 2 bits in the index here. Right. And that's it. And then we're done. And then you can look at the spectrum of these spin chains, and hopefully you're going to succeed in doing that. Do you see the idea here? Right? So now I have a... I can do this, and I can generate HV here, form my tridiagonal matrix, feed it into your Jacobi routine, and I'm done. And with a little luck, does anybody know how much memory are there on your laptops here? 200 megabytes? 4 gigs? Or?
Okay, then you can likely take
L here up to 20. It may, and that would mean that you can see, of course, that the Hilbert space here, the size will be 2 to the power L. And so I'm claiming that with this little trick on your laptop, you can diagonalize a matrix that would be 2 to the power 20 times 2 to the power 20. And we're all crossing our fingers it'll actually work, but it usually does. Lunch. Okay.